Case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the fifth case this morning, United States versus Niger. Ms. Lopez?
May it please the court, counsel for the government. My name is Lisa Lopez, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Lakhbir Niger, in this case. The issue in this case, Your Honors, are whether Mr. Niger's plea was entered into knowing and voluntarily, given the fact that he did not know his guideline range or corresponding base offense level at the time he pleaded guilty. In regard to the plea agreement is inherently vague. This was not a blind plea agreement we're talking about here. This is a fully written out plea agreement. And he received this only one day prior to his plea. If Your Honors take a look at the plea agreement, the heart of the matter that he's charged with, that being this is a tax case, and there is no corresponding base offense level for the tax offense with which he is charged. There are numerous numerical entries in the plea agreement stating what the government believes the loss amount would be, and yet there is no corresponding base offense level to give Mr. Niger any kind of indication as to the guideline range that corresponds with the base offense level that would correspond in the guideline range. And at the plea colloquy, the attorney for the defendant, or Mr. Niger, states that there is a dispute as to the loss amount. Well, in that case, there should have been a trigger saying that the government believes the loss amount is over $1 million, therefore corresponding to a level 22 in the guideline book and the corresponding guideline range. And if the defense had a different idea of what the loss amount would be, say less than $400,000, they should have clearly stated level 18 or level 20 or whatever the corresponding guideline level should be.
So there was a dispute, and certainly no agreement.
As
to what the loss amount would be, which would have a bearing on the guidelines, but there's this waiver in the agreement.
Right, exactly. And there's a waiver, and it's our position that because the agreement is unenforceable, that the waiver, because the agreement was entered into involuntary and unknowingly, that the waiver cannot be enforced
I've heard you arguing about the lack of knowledge, not knowing what the guideline range is going to be. And no defendant ever does, unless it's a 11C1C agreement, right? I mean,
well, that's true to a certain extent, Your Honor. The government, and there's certainly there's no concrete way to predict what a sentence is before the pre-sentence investigation report comes out. However,
and not even then, because the judge may disagree with the pre-sentence report.
Exactly, of course, yes, Your Honor. However, there's this missing component that goes to the knowledge of Mr. Niger, and that is at least an approximation of what he possibly could be facing. Yes, he was told what the statutory minimum was. There was no statutory
and
minimum.
Maximum.
Yes, he was told what the maximum was, yes. But we're looking at a range of 0 to 20 here, and there's no in-between. And in realistic practice, the guideline range is what narrows the judge uses as one of the tools in addition to the 3553A factors.
Well, as I said, I've heard you argue about what he didn't know. But what was involuntary about it? I'm not understanding there's no gun to his head. I don't see the compulsion for him to enter this agreement.
Well, I think that you're right, Your Honor. There was no gun to his head. However, with it being
not even a figurative gun to his head.
Exactly. Well, with it being involuntary, I think that he basically thought that he had no other choice than to enter into this agreement because. Again, he was told certain things, and I'm not bringing up ineffective assistance of counsel at this point, but he was given certain promises by certain people involved. And I shouldn't say promises, because I know that the language in the plea agreement specifically states that there was no promises made, and I know that the plea colloquy, the judge says that there was no promises made. But I think he had certain – his expectations were quite different than what they ended up being.
Well, you always hope for the best, right?
Well, of course, always hope for the best. But again, without this plea being knowing, we contend that this appellate waiver is unenforceable. And
so it's the knowingness, it's not the involuntariness that is causing that supports your argument.
Well, I would say it's definitely the more knowing that weighs greater in our favor as opposed to the involuntariness. But we still contend that it was involuntary, given the fact that if he had a better idea of what he faced, he may not have pleaded guilty. And in regard to the second issue that's contained therein, the Rule 11 was violated at the plea colloquy by the judge's failure to mention that the district court would consider the 3553A factors at sentencing. Mr. Niger was not aware of this fact. They're briefly mentioned in the plea agreement. However, the plea agreement merely states that the judge would have to consider the factors, and they don't lay out what they are. And it's our contention that he didn't know what they were. He didn't know what else would be considered sentencing, because this whole sentencing was completely, the whole plea agreement was very vague. The plea colloquy was very vague. And even when it comes down to the sentencing, there was no memorandums filed by either side setting forth what their respective positions would be. And without that, without either one of those two, without any kind of sentencing memorandums or concrete numerical calculations as to what he faced, his plea was clearly entered into knowing and unknowing and involuntary. And for those reasons, we ask that this court allow Mr. Niger to withdraw his guilty plea.
Thank you, counsel.
And please, court, counsel. The defendant here, in order to get the relief he seeks, must convince this court that the district court's decision to accept his plea, his guilty plea, was plainly erroneous. In argument today, counsel suggests that the critical factor to look at with respect to the defendant's knowing factor of his guilty plea rests upon the magistrate court's alleged deficiency to not provide him with a guideline calculation or an estimate. As this court knows, Rule 11 does not require a guideline calculation or estimate to be afforded at any defendant's change of plea hearing. In fact, the law counsels against that. The defendant was represented. The defendant had the benefit of a written plea agreement. Counsel says that he only had the plea agreement, got the plea agreement a day before this change of plea hearing. However, change of plea hearing, the counsel advised the court that counsel had spent over 3 hours the day before going over the plea agreement with the defendant.
The defendant had two counsel from two different firms?
Yes, Your Honor. And that both counsel had gone over the plea agreement, and that it was their view that he understood the plea agreement. The transcript of the change of plea hearing makes it clear that the magistrate judge went to great pains to ensure that the defendant understood his rights, understood what the provisions of the plea agreement were, in fact, made sure that the defendant had a copy of the plea agreement in front of him during the Rule 11 colloquy. And practically speaking, Let me back up a little bit. It was clear from at the change of plea hearing that the issue of loss was to be reserved for sentencing. Now, there was a little bit of some dispute, not so much dispute, but some confusion. The plea agreement actually represents that the only issue to be resolved at the sentencing was the amount of restitution. However, at the change of plea hearing, government counsel said that that she and defense counsel had agreed that the amount of loss, tax loss, was to be reserved for at the time of sentencing. Now, those are two different concepts, obviously, but in this case, it was, I guess, primarily the same number, the tax loss and the amount of restitution. But the part of but the lengthy stipulation of facts, which were read in open court, which were contained in the plea agreement, set forth a tax loss figure. It set forth the government's assessment of what that tax loss was. So practically speaking, the defendant could easily have used that tax loss figure to make an estimate with his attorneys, the guideline estimate on what his potential guideline sentence was. And in fact, he got a substantially below guideline sentence. But that would have been enough, certainly, to let the defendant know what his potential guideline would be if the district, the probation office and the district court sided with the government that that was the amount of tax loss. More importantly, the defendant did not object to the loss amount that was contained in the pre-sentence report. He had every opportunity to if he thought that the tax loss was overstated or he was surprised by it, but he didn't even object to it. So clearly he understood that that was the amount of money that he might be held accountable to. With respect to the 3553A factors, that is, if there's any deficiency or any error there, it's harmless at best. Did not affect the defendant's substantial rights. The plea agreement clearly set forth that the sentencing court would take into account the 3553A factors when imposing a sentence. There was a discussion at the change of plea hearing. The magistrate judge says, you understand that the sentencing court can impose a sentence based on other factors, that regardless of the recommendation of the parties, and that you defendant do not have a right to withdraw your guilty plea just because you are unsatisfied with the ultimate sentence. The defendant said yes, he understood that. And the defendant makes no claim that he would have decided not to plead guilty had there been a more thorough discussion of the 3553A factors, nor could he, really, because the plea agreement set that out, the defendant did not object to the report and recommendation to the district court and did not object to the pre-sentence report after it was completed. So for all of those reasons, unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that the district court's decision to deny the defendant's we ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment and the decision to deny his motion to withdraw a guilty plea.
So you're not asking for dismissal of the appeal on the waiver?
We are, Your Honor, and I guess I got the cart ahead of the course. Certainly, we do not abandon our appellate waiver argument, and I think that is the first line of our argument, is that this was a knowing and voluntary plea agreement. There was an appeal waiver. The magistrate court went over the appeal waiver in great detail with the defendant, and he cannot be heard now to suggest that he did not understand it by signing that plea agreement. He was waiving the appeal. So we would ask for dismissal on the appeal waiver, but if the court would go to the merits, we think even the merits demand affirmance.
Thank you, counsel. Two minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, in regard to the guideline sentence, Mr. Niger did receive a guideline sentence. It was decided by the court to impose.
It was not a below guideline sentence.
It was not a below guideline
sentence.
It was within the guideline range. Yes, that's the first correction. And secondly, in regard to the appellate waiver, the appellate waiver was impermissibly vague, and because the plea colloquy was.
Oh, you're challenging the language of the waiver.
I'm challenging the fact that the waiver's in there, not necessarily. I'm saying that the language of the waiver was. The language in the plea agreement was impermissibly vague, and because the waiver was in there, that the plea agreement itself should not be enforced.
Okay, because I was confused, but I didn't see that in your brief. You're not saying that the language of the waiver is ambiguous.
No, I'm not.
The waiver is clear.
I apologize for that. I'm not saying the language of the waiver is ambiguous. I am saying that the plea agreement itself is ambiguous because it's lacking so many critical points. And I realize that Rule 11 does not require, there's no post-Booker, not that I know of, post-Booker case law that allows, that requires that the guidelines are to be included within the plea agreement. However, under the 3553A factors, we all know that one of the factors the judge must consider are the guidelines themselves. And without those being in the plea agreement, there's no way for Mr. Niger to have known what the guidelines were. And it's our contention that the district court did commit plain error, because this error was obvious in the sense that there.
So our rule will be then all plea agreements must have a projection of the guideline range in them, otherwise they're vague.
I would stay with keeping up with the spirit of the Siegel case that was just decided that I wasn't aware of at the time that I submitted this brief, that I would consider it, yes, a best practice to consider.
The Siegel case involved supervised
yes,
religion,
I understand,
or
but,
supervised
but,
release.
But
I'm
Judge
sorry.
Posner did at the end state a best practices that he wanted to impose on sentencing judges, and I would say that it would be a best practice for both the government and the defense to at least have some kind of preliminary calculation. I noticed that my time was up. May I finish responding?
Yes, you may. Sure.
Yeah, I would say that it would be a best practice to be on some kind of footing, equal footing, with terms of what the guidelines, anticipated guidelines, are, and if they're to be disputed or not. So for those reasons, I ask that the plea agreement be allowed to be withdrawn. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.